funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What makes diamonds so special to us? The physical properties of these tiny bits of compressed carbon make them useful in some industrial applications, and the way they sparkle when carefully cut is pleasing to the eye. But for most of us, the significance of diamonds goes far beyond that. We associate them with wealth, with glamour, even with love. And as my guest today will tell us, the symbolism we attach to diamonds is an interesting lens through which to examine the way we assign meaning to objects of all kinds. Susan Falls teaches anthropology at the Savannah College of Art and Design. Her new book is called Clarity, Cut, and Culture: The Many Meanings of Diamonds. Susan, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
One interesting thing about diamonds is the way that they're valuable to us on a variety of levels. They tend to cost a lot of money. We think they're beautiful, but they're also a signal to other people.
That's right. And this is, if I can just unpack this a little bit, they can cost a lot, but sometimes there's a tremendous amount of diamonds that come onto the market every year now. And they're not all tremendously expensive. Diamonds come at all price points. And something like over 70% of all American women own at least one diamond, whether they, you know, wear and use those diamonds regularly or not. And so this is one aspect of this question. And the other aspect of the question has to do with the kind of sentimental attachments that we may or may not have to them. And because of the ways in which diamonds are valued from a market perspective, compared to the way that they're valued from the perspective of the person that has it, the consumer, they make sort of odd status symbols in many kinds of ways, because your average person really, you know, just sees diamonds at a glance, just maybe on someone's hand or on someone's ears or around your neck, and it's very, very difficult to discern if it's something that's, you know, very expensive, something that's sort of medium expensive, or something that's rather inexpensive just by the eye. So it makes for kind of an odd status symbol for that reason.
And a lot of the people that you talked to made a point of stressing the fact that there are a lot of fakes out there, sort of implying that what they have is not fake, but a lot of other people must have things that are not genuine.
Right. And this question of simulated and synthetic diamonds is really interesting. It is very difficult to tell the difference between, you know, a natural diamond and a synthetic diamond or a simulated diamond. And although I think a lot of times people feel like they could look at one and tell whether it was fake or not, and indeed they might be able to if the object in question is made out of something like glass or a piece of quartz that was sort of, masquerading as a diamond. They might, you know, suspect that it was fake, but a lot of the times, especially some of the kind of newer synthetics, they actually look extremely real. And even for an experienced jeweler, it might be very difficult to tell.
So why would we ever pay for a genuine diamond if we could get a cubic zirconia or a moissanite, or however you say it, for a fraction of the cost?
That's a great question. That was one of the questions that I asked myself, and one of the questions that I talked with to people that were working with me in the study. And actually, some people said that they wouldn't care if it was a moissanite or a cubic zirconia, as long as it did. What mattered to them was who gave it to them.
Hmm.
Or some people said that they would rather have a larger simulated diamond than a real one that was very, very small. On the other hand, I know at least one person told me that her father had given her mother a diamond, a special diamond for Christmas one year, after they had been married for many, many years. And she opened up the box and she said, you know, my mother was one of the most gracious people in the world, and she absolutely loved and adored my father. But she opened the box, she took one look at this thing, she tossed it back to him and said, "This is fake." And she wasn't about to put that on. I think that, you know, for some people, the idea of the ways in which these, you know, objects are formed in the ground and their age and the idea that nature has made this very, you know, special kind of mineral is, you know, sort of plays into the preference for a natural stone.
Okay, so I think, like maybe a lot of people, was under the impression that it's sort of hard to find a diamond. As it turns out, it's hard to mine a diamond, but we know where lots of them are.
We do, and you know, nowadays, many, many more diamonds come onto the market than used to be the case. You know, hundreds millions of carats. And so, you know, part of the value of a diamond, part of the way that we think about diamonds is with regard to this notion of scarcity, that they're very, very scarce. And this is a narrative that has been around for a long time. And actually, it is true that you know, a couple of centuries ago, these things were extremely scarce. In the late 1600s, you know, finding a diamond was very unusual. It was maybe 75,000 diamonds found or discovered each year, and only a small fraction of these would have been of gem quality. So, you know, it wasn't until maybe, you know, certainly over the last century, and definitely over the last probably 2 to 3 decades, that there's just really been a huge increase in the number of diamonds that have been, that, you know, that come onto the market each year.
But they're not really getting any cheaper.
I'm sorry?
They're not getting much cheaper, are they?
No.
So how do you explain that? This is like market economics turned upside down.
Well, it is, and there's been an incredibly successful advertising campaign that has,
You know, take a sip of water, and I'll reintroduce the book. My guest is Susan Falls, who teaches anthropology at the Savannah College of Art and Design. We're talking about her book, Clarity, Cut, and Culture, The Many Meanings of Diamonds. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. Maybe tell a story about your favorite diamond or a fake diamond that you threw back in someone's face. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Susan, how you doing now?
Thank you so much.
Sure. No problem. I've been there. All right. So we were talking about the fact that diamonds now, how many is it that De Beers pulls out of the ground every year? I couldn't believe the number of carats.
Well, hundreds of thousands of carats. Hmm. And, you know, De Beers is used to really be in charge of upwards of 90% of the rough that came out, rough diamonds that came out of the ground. Those numbers have changed a little bit since other mining outfits have come online. Diamonds have been discovered in other places in the world, and but nevertheless, De Beers is still an extremely important player in all this, and they have really been masterful in terms of marketing these items. And I think when I last looked, some of the ideas around how, like for example, how much should you spend for an engagement ring? It used to be a month's salary was sort of the ways, some of the ways in which people talked about this. Then it sort of edged up to 2 months, and now some people say that one should spend 3 months' salary on an engagement stone, which I think for most people is really a tremendous outlay, you know,
yeah.
Resources, especially for a young, probably, you know, a person that's sort of starting out in the world as an adult. That's a really tremendous outlay.
And it's strange that this has become something, I mean, I don't want to, you know, generalize too much, but many people sort of believe that this is something you have to do in the way that they don't necessarily believe that you have to do a lot of other things associated with milestones in your life. Why is it that, how did the diamond engagement ring become so tied in to the rituals that we have that surround marriage?
Well, it's a really interesting history, actually. And, you know, I think sometimes people are really surprised to learn that diamonds were not something that were always associated with women, nor were diamonds something that was always associated with, you know, engagements. And the establishment of the engagement ring tradition has really been part of a marketing adventure that was undertaken by De Beers, and they've been extremely successful at, you know, attaching the idea of the legitimacy of an engagement to an engagement ring that's a diamond ring. And indeed, the engagement ring market really is the driver behind the diamond market in general inside the context of the United States. And other places, a legitimate engagement is not necessarily accompanied by a diamond ring.
Hmm. And then I suppose the De Beers and other Diamond Company marketers started seeing the writing on the wall, saw that people are getting married later, maybe aren't choosing to get married at all. And so now they're encouraging women of a certain age to buy their own diamonds for the other hand.
Right. The right hand ring, the right hand diamond, or the diamond on the bling finger, and I've met many women who, for various and sundry reasons, were buying diamonds for themselves. And you know, I think part of this has to do with a need to expand the market. That is to say, you know, because there's so many more diamonds coming on the market today, there's a need to find other ways to sell them, new ways to sell them. And this has been something that the diamond industry and other kinds of industries have, you know, struggled with from time to time. So there's been various and sundry attempts to, you know, make new markets, to make new products, to find people that may not have previously bought diamonds to buy them. The right hand ring is something that has been very, very successful and has targeted women who maybe are not married, who are might feel themselves as to be sort of liberated in a particular way, or who have expendable income that they're willing to, you know, part with in exchange for, you know, jewelry. And a lot of times that kind of jewelry is colored diamonds. One of the things that I think sometimes people are surprised to learn is that, like, truly clear diamonds, a truly clear diamond really is relatively rare. Diamonds come in every color, red, green, blue, yellow, purple, brown, even black, white. And, you know, a long time ago, the diamonds that were sort of brown or yellowy, they were really viewed as, you know, of inferior quality, and there really wasn't a market for them. Now the colored stone market starts to come online a little bit, and with the attachment of names like Cognac, Champagne, Canary, those kinds of words that might, I don't know, attach a sort of different set of meanings to it than just a yellow stone or a brown stone, have given them a little bit of something special or extra value, or people see them as something kind of unusual and wonderful. And indeed, the right-hand market has sort of been able to absorb some of those stones that might otherwise not be that attractive to people.
But the idea is you don't have to wait around for someone else to give you this thing. If you want a diamond and you feel like you deserve it, you should go for it, which implies that somehow we all continue to associate the idea of owning a diamond with being special in some way or deserving something.
Well, I think, yes, I think that many people do sort of think about them in that way. However, you know, there are moves by many groups of people to sort of critique that narrative in different ways. One of these is the right hand ring. Of course, you know, if we wanted to really talk about the bling ring and who, you know, the sort of use of diamonds by the hip hop community, that's a very, very different kind of use of these stones that operates both oddly as a sort of celebration of and as a critique in some ways of that, of this sort of, you know, narrative of engagement and marriage and waiting and some of the other, you know, kind of ideas that we might associate with them.
Susan Falls is my guest. She teaches anthropology at the Savannah College of Art and Design. Her new book is called Clarity, Cut, and Culture, The Many Meanings of Diamonds. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, ask a question, maybe share a diamond story, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Susan Falls, who teaches anthropology at the Savannah College of Art and Design and is author of the new book, Clarity, Cut, and Culture, The Many Meanings of Diamonds. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think at kera.org. Susan, before the break, you brought up the fact that, for example, hip-hop stars and rappers will wear diamond-encrusted, like, gigantic medallions or rings or things, and they're both acknowledging and also sort of pushing back against the meanings that the broader culture has assigned to diamonds.
Right. So, I mean, I think that it's kind of interesting to note that the word bling, for example, entered into the Oxford English Dictionary in 2005. So that just sort of to give a sort of historical context to this. And I think, you know, most people, you know, would readily have an idea of what these stones look like when they're worn by a rapper, hip-hop star. And they wear big diamonds. They wear them in, you know, gigantic settings, lots of diamonds with text. There's all kinds of ways in which these diamonds are being showcased, but in a way that kind of plays with, makes fun of, but also simultaneously refers to the notion of wealth that are, you know, are attached to these stones. They really, because of their size and because of the way that they're worn, they really make us pay attention to the diamonds and to the jewelry in a way that we might not normally look at them. And so it sort of forces us, in a sense, to think about the ways in which we sort of usually use these stones in a way that we don't talk about, we don't think about it, we don't notice it that much on other people unless there's something really particular about it. And so it's a very, very interesting phenomenon, even to the point that now, as, you know, just like, you know, many critiques, the critique that is somewhat brought about by the hip-hop community now gets folded back into the sort of, you know, world of haute couture and even the world of just regular everyday stones. So it has this sort of very interesting conversation with a more, dare I say, middle-class way of sort of wearing them, thinking about them, using them.
So we in the middle class tend to associate diamonds with wealth, even if 70% of us might own a diamond and don't think of ourselves as wealthy. But as you point out, you know, you can buy diamonds at Harry Winston, but you can buy them at most Walmarts these days as well.
That's correct. They really come at every price point. And in some ways, this has led to a sort of democratization of the wearing of diamonds, which is kind of interesting considering the fact that in the mid-15th century, when King Charles VII gave a pendant to Agnes Sorel, diamonds were, you know, had been very recent to that under sumptuary law. They were only for the elite. They were something that were for men. And it's really, you know, almost come to the, you know, done a 180 turn in terms of, you know, who can have a diamond, who can wear a diamond, who has access to these stones.
And these days, women, I guess, are largely the people who wear diamonds every day. Mm-hmm. And you point out the fact that because diamonds are as small as they are, they take on significance simply because we have them on every single day for decades at a time. And so they become part of our sort of the identity that we present to the world.
That's right. And even sort of taking that a step further, many people that I talked with told me that diamonds that they had received from, you know, a loved one, a mother, an aunt, a sister, a mother-in-law, sometimes people really have the feeling that these stones carry the emotions, the experiences, the memories, the sentiments. They absorb the personality of the person who's had the stone. And this can make them both incredibly loved, coveted, items that people like to wear every day as part of their and sort of incorporated into their own identity. Mm-hmm. But it also means that sometimes people find them too powerful, too emotional. They may be attached to memories that aren't so happy, but they want to keep the object, but they don't necessarily want to wear it. And so this sometimes leads to a situation in which people have diamonds, but they just keep them in a box somewhere. They would never sell them. They don't want to give them away. They're viewed as too precious and valuable for that. But it's not something that you would maybe necessarily want to wear, or might be sort of, you know, you might not want to wear it, you might not want to give it to a new bride because of the history that it has attached to it. People are very, very unwilling to wear, you know, quote-unquote used diamonds, which I think is so interesting because it's not like, it is a little bit different from a pair of shoes or something like that that, you know, actually shows, you know, signs of wear and tear. A diamond doesn't, you know, necessarily do that, doesn't usually do that. So, you know, it looks basically the same now as it did, you know, 30 years ago.
But I guess we walk into a pawn shop and see a diamond and assume something bad happened to that marriage or else the stone would not be for sale.
Right. Why is it here in the pawn shop? Exactly.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go on the phone now to Michael in Dallas. Hi, Michael.
Hello. How are you?
Great. Thank you. Go right ahead, please.
Yes. I just wanted to chime in on the author's take on the diamonds. And I was listening to the show and taking in all of what she said, and I just want to throw my two cents in. I kind of believe what you said earlier, that I think that the marketing strategy has been a driving force on how diamonds have gotten to be, quote, so precious and so important in one's life. I find that it's just extremely good in the sense of how they play value up, and I just don't agree with it.
Michael, you're absolutely right that this campaign has been extremely successful, and one of the questions that I wanted to know was how did this happen? Because in some ways, if I could just push what you're saying a little bit. In some ways, really what we're talking about are tiny pieces of polished gravel. And we've taken these tiny pieces of polished gravel, and through a tremendous amount of cultural work, both from, you know, the diamond industry itself, but also from, you know, just sort of regular people like me, you know, given it this value and this status. Now, that's... one of the sort of interesting things about that is, you know, when we start to think about, well, what is value? Where does value come from? That if we can talk about economic value, sentimental value, we could talk about the value that we might give to something based on the labor that's involved in it, based on, you know, the cost of moving it around the world. Those are some of the ways that we can establish the value of something, not just a diamond, but anything like a pair of eyeglasses or a pair of shoes or, a particular kind of television set or a particular type of car. And it is true. You're absolutely right. It is true that much of the value that we associate with these little glittery stones is culturally constructed. That is to say, it's something that we sort of make as a society. Having said that, it is also the case that most commodities that have a sort of status value operate in the same way. And so I think that that sort of opens up a whole range of questions about the ways in which we sort of think about material culture, how we use material culture. We surround ourselves with things. Most of us surround ourselves with things that we've bought at one point or another or someone else has bought and given to us. And we develop an identity based on these material objects. We perform an identity to other people. We see other people's, you know, objects, their commodities, and we might, you know, to think about them in a particular way with regard to race or class or gender or, you know, some other age or regionalism or something like that. And so I think that your question is, the comment that you made is a very, very insightful comment and sort of speaks to the ways in which we give meaning to material culture, and then we use those meanings to help us to move through the world in a particular way.
What's interesting about that, Susan, is that even for individuals who feel like they don't wish to subscribe to the things that material culture says that they need to value, even if people are wearing like all thrift store clothes or whatever, we're still using our possessions. And I want to make clear that some people, you know, are limited financially as to what is available to them. But for people who have a choice, even if they believe they're choosing a non-material path, they're still defining themselves according to what they do or do not own.
That's true. And I think that the comment that you make is really important because people do, make choices about the kind of material culture that they're going to clothe themselves in, as it were. And some, you know, these choices, of course, are somewhat directed by the universe of meaning that we live in, the marketing, the advertisements that we see all around us, you know, product placement, the meanings that other people attribute to things that, you know, operates on us with regard to, you know, sort of a peer, in a peer pressure kind of way, or, you know, the people that you know, of course, that operates on us. But one of the things that I found that was so interesting was even in the face of a sort of extremely successful advertising campaign that does attach sort of glamour, love, status to these stones, people find all kinds of different ways to read them from their side. People are very, very, very creative when it comes to interpreting their own stones, and even idiosyncratic. And so what that, you know, means for us, for people that are sort of thinking about the way that material culture works, is that there's departures from the status quo all around us all the time, so that, you know, sort of a creative individuality or even dissent from the status quo, like, you know, wearing a diamond engagement ring, might be in plain sight if we will only look and ask. Because sometimes people that might look to be using material culture in a somewhat, you know, conservative way, once you start talking to them, you might learn that actually they think about it in a very idiosyncratic way. They've sort of rendered their own creative interpretation of what it is that they're doing. But unless you know that person personally and talk with them about it, you might not ever get to that.
On the other hand, we do we are safe asking about that diamond ring or necklace or pair of earrings, whereas we don't necessarily say to someone, your eyeglasses are so interesting. What do they make you think about, and why did you choose them? Even though it's also something that we wear every day.
Right. And this was a question that this problem was something that I kind of struggled with when I first started doing this research, because you can, if you want to get to the meaning of something, you can sort of ask somebody, what is the meaning of your shoes? Like, it's such a weird question. It's such a strange thing to say. And because, you know, we're not ever asked to answer questions like that. So most people, they don't know what to do with a question like that. I know I wouldn't know what to do with a weird question like that. And so the way to get at it, I guess, one way to get at it is just through storytelling. And it's through just sort of hearing people tell stories about their own stuff that, you know, I could sort of learn about what it meant to them.
Were there people, as you were doing your interviews, were there people whose stories really appealed to you and felt very genuine, and other people that you felt maybe were more materialistic than the stories they told themselves would have indicated?
Oh, yes. And you know, the context of the interview is always incredibly important.
Mm-hmm.
People may, of course, just like in any kind of conversation, they always are sort of, you know, we're having a conversation, but they also might be sort of performing an identity based on what they think your expectations are, or what they think you might say, or, you know, what they think you're looking for. And so, the first couple of things that people say are just sort of, they present doorways to you, and it's not until later on in the conversation that you really get to the nitty-gritty of what things mean to people, and you don't always get there, of course.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Betsy in Grapevine. Hi, Betsy.
Hi. I was thinking about the way that little girls grow up. They've got the you've got the toys with the jewelry. There's the erasers that are the big look diamond looking rings. I mean, it's kind of part of growing up as a little girl. And I'm kind of wondering if that has anything. Does that carry over into other cultures? For example, in India, is that an important thing? Are diamonds an important stone?
Well, that's a great question. And, of course, the kinds of things that we play growing up have a tremendous impact on the ways in which we, you know, think about things when we grow up. I mean, I know I played with, you know, pasties and things like that. And India is a really interesting example because the first diamond industry was in India. But those gems were alluvial, which means that they were just on the ground. They had already found their way up to the surface, and through rain and erosion, they were all spread all over the place. And so there was a small cutting industry there. And it wasn't until really the last couple of decades that the diamond industry really went back to India in a very revived way. At the moment, the diamond industry in India is absolutely booming, and diamonds, as a result of that, are becoming more important in the society there.
You had quite an education when you went to sort of study how diamonds are valued. There's the four C's, right? Clarity, cut, color, and
carats?
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. And what did you learn about that maybe took you by surprise?
Well, the first time I looked at a diamond through a little microscope, a little loop, I was absolutely enchanted by it. There's a whole tiny world in there. And when you look at it that closely, you really can appreciate the differences that you can't really see by the eye. So for, you know, someone who's a real diamond aficionado, looking at a very, very high-quality stone in that way is a very different experience from looking at something that might have some slight occlusions in it or is not well cut. It's just a very different experience. But, of course, most of the time, people just see them from afar. I think very, very few people have the opportunity to learn what those very minute distinctions are, even microscopic distinctions that can turn out to make a difference in the price.
Susan Falls is with us. She teaches anthropology at the Savannah College of Art and Design, and she's the author of the new book, Clarity, Cut, and Culture, The Many Meanings of Diamonds. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with anthropologist Susan Falls, author of the new book, Clarity, Cut, and Culture, The Many Meanings of Diamonds. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. We have an email here from Ron who says, given the enormous number of diamonds that have been sold over more than a century, where are those diamonds now? One might guess there are millions of them somewhere.
That's a very interesting question. Well, some of the diamonds, as we were talking about earlier, turn up in pawn shops. There's not a tremendous demand for used diamonds, so there's not much of a secondary market for them. I think many of the stones that have been sold over the years are in little jewelry boxes in people's houses, is where a lot of them are being stored at the moment. As I said, like, you know, something like over 70% of all American women own at least one diamond, and this is a, you know, this is a number that, you know, 50 years ago definitely would not have been the case. So people tend to keep them. They keep them in the family. They give them to their children. They give them to their nieces or nephews, as it were. And so people kind of tend to keep them in the family.
What's interesting is that I think a lot of people justify spending more than they otherwise would on a diamond, thinking, well, if anything ever goes wrong, I can just sell that thing and get my money back. And it turns out that's not really the case.
Right. That's something that many people, I think, have the idea that it's almost like having a little tiny insurance policy, you know, where a beautiful and tiny insurance policy. And I mean, unless you know someone that's, you know, able to and willing to take the diamond at full price, it is very, very difficult to sell a diamond on the market yourself. As I'm sure everybody knows, a pawn shop is not a great option.
Mm-hmm.
There has sort of developed, now that there's a kind of like so more of a developed, you know, sort of Craigslist social media world, I think sometimes people sell them that way. But in terms of, you know, getting the value for which it was, you know, initially purchased, probably not.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with Scott in Dallas. Hey, Scott.
Hi, Chris. How you doing?
Great. Thank you.
This is a very interesting topic, and I wanted to ask your guest, does a particular cut of a stone, I know that size does matter, but I was wondering about the cut of the diamond. If there are varying degrees of, let's say, gauged affluence attached to a specific cut, like emerald or mm-hmm. Asher
mm-hmm.
or princess or trillion.
Right.
An interesting question.
Okay. Well, yes and no. The value of any particular stone really is a combination of what's known as the four C's, so color, carat, clarity, and, of course, cut. There's lots and lots of different cuts. Some of the ones that, Scott, that you named are well-known cuts, but every year there's people that develop new cuts, and there's hundreds and thousands of these, maybe thousands of these different kinds of cuts, and I'm not sure that your average person would necessarily be able to look at them and tell. They would think that, you know, it's round or it's a square cut. Depending upon how well the cut is executed, that could very much impact the value of the stone on the market, if that makes sense. So, like, let's say you have a stone that is, you know, has very high color grade and very high clarity grade and is big, but it's very, very poorly cut, even if it's a kind of, you know, special cut, but it's very poorly cut. That particular stone might not do as well in terms of its, you know, translated into its price as something that has maybe a more common cut, but very, very well executed.
Is it easy to make a mistake in cutting a diamond? Like, can you just destroy, like, a one-carat diamond by slipping your finger somehow?
You could. If it had, you know, a small, tiny crack or some kind of inclusion, which is sometimes clarity grades that are a little bit lower, can begin to impact the wearability of the stone. If it, you know, if you hit it just right,
mm-hmm.
it could, you know, crack or crumble.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Matt in Fort Worth. Hi, Matt.
Hi there. I love your show, and it's good to be on and get to talk to your guest.
Welcome.
I hope I understood this correctly, because I've seen similar changes in other industries, and was going to ask if what you're saying is that in the diamond industry, there's all kinds of fashion changes where they'll have different shapes or sizes or ways to market the product. But I think what I hear you saying is that you might see what might be considered more of a tradition change, that people are looking at it maybe a little differently. And when they think about throwing $1,000, say, at a diamond, they're second-guessing what kind of value they're getting, because I'm seeing second-guessing of lots of different industries, you know, whether it's traditional medicine, traditional way we get our food, traditional energy. And am I understanding correctly, there's in kind of a reassessment of the value of a purchase of a diamond?
Well, I think that really depends on who you ask. I mean, the diamond engagement ring industry or market is as strong as it ever has been. It's certainly not suffering in any way. However, having said that, I think that some people are thinking about the meaning of it. There's definitely a way in which other kinds of markets are being explored for diamonds, some of which we had talked about earlier. Other colors are being explored, different kinds of settings, and even the rise of branded diamonds, which, you know, as you say, these are objects that are operating in the economy just like any other kind of commodity. So, you know, the rise of sort of branding practices with regard to diamonds is something that has very much impacted the different levels at which these things are sold, even though sometimes the branding on a diamond might be something that's just lasered onto the girdle right there around the edge of it. And it's not even something that you could even see with the naked eye, but people might, people would know themselves if it were branded or not, and that might impact the ways in which they would think about it. This makes it a kind of odd commodity in a way, though, because you can't see the brand name. It's not like, having a Mercedes medallion on the front of your car that everybody can see and recognize. No one can see this thing. So it's very, very interesting, I think, to think about the ways in which branding operates with these little objects.
The marketing of diamonds is fascinating in that it really preys on not only people's desire for material status in the world, for, the respect of people who think they have access to ready disposable income, but it also kind of preys on the fact that people want to wear a diamond to show how much they are loved by whoever gave it to them.
Some people very much take that point of view, and some people take it quite explicitly. For example, one woman that I was talking with told me that, she told her, fiancé, don't even come around here with anything less than a carat. Said, but, he wouldn't want that. He wouldn't want anyone to think that he would, buy something smaller than a carat for me. And really, I knew that I was just setting the bar pretty low. So she, even though, later in the conversation when it came out that she really didn't care so much about having a diamond, but what she really cared about was that people would think or feel like he had, stepped up to the plate and that he was capable, able to purchase this thing for her, and that she felt that it would maybe reflect poorly upon him if she didn't have this. So, the ways in which people think about this is really not very simple at all. It doesn't operate very well as sort of a sort of vanilla status symbol,
mm-hmm.
because there's other people involved and sort of imagining the ways in which people might interpret someone else's behavior based on what you have.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next on the phone to Stephen in Frisco. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Great, thank you.
Good. Enjoy your show.
Thank you.
And a question I have is really about synthetic diamonds. They're basically available at a fraction of the cost of real diamonds. They're actually better quality in that they have, they're more towards the flawless end. They have better color consistency. There's no ethical issues around how they're fabricated or obtained. And I'm wondering about if your guests have seen any more market acceptance of those or not.
I think for some segments of the population, for some people, they don't care. They don't care if it's simulated. They don't care if it's synthetic. It is true that especially with regard to some of the ethical issues of the diamond industry that, became apparent about 10 years ago with the sort of blood diamonds and, sort of conflict stones material that became very visible in our society, people were began to have doubts about the morality of what purchasing these stones that had such a storied history or, storied industry, at least at that point in time. And there was a move for some people to move towards synthetic stones. And, in fact, the diamond industry itself became extremely concerned about the impact that these moral or ethical questions might have on diamond consumption and very quickly moved to attempt to police the internal pipeline of diamonds from, from the mine to cutting to the retail market that would minimize the number of stones that could be linked to civil war, especially civil war that was, so brutal and just very, very ugly. Now, having said that, many people, I think, still feel like they would prefer to have something that was a natural stone. And I think there's many different sort of cultural ideologies, if you will, that help to foster this idea that people want a natural stone. But you're absolutely right that, synthetic stones might have a more regular quality. And one of, I think, the most fascinating kinds of synthetic stones are produced by a company called Life Gem, and now there's some other companies that do this as well, and they actually take cremation remains, submit them to a process of pressure and heat, and actually produce synthetic diamonds, and I find this to be absolutely amazing.
Well, I'd like to add to that. There's I'm not affiliated with them at all, but Nexus Diamonds has a process that unbelievable quality. So I think it's available on the market now.
Absolutely.
Do you have diamonds, Susan?
You know, I do have some diamonds, and my grandmother gave me a beautiful old mine cut stone that my grandfather had given to her after they were first married, and it's a diamond that I don't wear it all the time. I only wear it for sort of special occasions when I'm with my family or for a special event or when I sort of want to feel her near me or with me. Mm. I wear it, but it's definitely not something that I wear every day.
Now, when you were doing your research and you were in the Diamond District and you were there for an extended period of time, I mean, did you find yourself, like, craving diamonds in a way that you hadn't before? Or what was your relationship to these stones when you were in the thick of learning about them?
Well, in the beginning, I really had absolutely no relationship with them at all. I'm not a person who wears a lot of jewelry or really don't care about jewelry that much. It's not something that I think about or, you know, covet. So when I chose them for a totally, you know, different, chose diamonds for sort of a theoretical reason. Yeah. And when I started looking at these things, I started thinking about, you know, the value of them, the sort of cultural construction, and I kind of really found them to be very weird, and I didn't like them at all. And the more I learned about them, then I started to love them, and I became completely enchanted with them, and just amazed by all. They do have some sort of special mineral qualities. And, you know, throughout the time, and even since then, I sort of go back and forth, have this real love-hate relationship with these sort of these glittery stones.
I guess that makes you like a lot of the people that you studied and profiled.
Yeah.
Susan Falls teaches anthropology at the Savannah College of Art and Design. Her new book is called Clarity, Cut, and Culture, The Many Meanings of Diamonds. Susan, thank you very much for spending this hour with us.
Chris, thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help on the phones today from Christina Ulsh. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.